Hello there, I'm Chuck Todd, and this is the Chuck Toddcast. So last year brought some encouraging news for the veteran community. The Department of Veterans Affairs announced that suicides by military veterans decreased in 2020 for the second year in a row. At an average of 16 suicides a day, fewer veterans died by suicide in 2020 than in any year since 2006, according to this report. And to think that that happened in a COVID year is perhaps more encouraging. The VA counted 6,146 deaths from suicide among veterans in 2020, the most recent year with reportable data. It's 343 fewer instances than the year prior and the sharpest decline in those two decades. But advocates are saying there's more to the story. America's Warrior Partnership, a national suicide prevention nonprofit, said the VA may be undercounting deaths by suicide. And when factoring in unexplained or accidental deaths, as well as record-keeping mistakes, it claims the real number is actually double what was reported by the government. So it's a real question here what the real number is. And this comes as veterans have gotten a renewed focus with the war in Ukraine. A month after Russia invaded its neighbor, a network of U.S. vets called the Mozart Group began training Ukrainian soldiers and evacuating frontline residents. The Mozart Group eventually collapsed, but it underscored many veterans' willingness to continue serving communities after the conclusion of their official U.S. service. Joined now by Paul Rykoff. He's the founder of Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America, and he's president of Righteous Media, one of the great independent media operators out there these days. Paul, it's good to see you.
Good to see you too, my friend. I think Memorial Day is always a time for reflection. You know, you mentioned the VA suicide numbers. I don't think there's any place in
Washington. What do you believe? What should we believe?
I don't think there's any place in Washington that's quicker to spike the ball than the White House, except maybe the VA. The VA loves to spike the ball early, and it's important to note that these suicide numbers are 2 years old because that's the lag in data. So it's a notoriously difficult place to pin down data, and I would not be celebrating by any means because what I see is an increased level of stress across the community. I know that CDC data, for example, doesn't capture cause of death in every state, and we know there's been tremendous stress across the veterans community that's cumulative. So some of it is from COVID. A lot of it is the moral strain of Afghanistan. A lot of it is just exhaustion. And I think there's always numbers beneath the numbers. And one of the things that nobody wants to talk about is that among males who die by suicide in America, about 50% of civilians die via firearms. In the veterans community, it's 70. So we're seeing, you know, a direct link between access to guns and suicide. And it's a radioactive political issue that most folks don't want to touch. But those of us who are understanding the science of suicide and trying to lead towards solutions are not spiking the ball. We see tremendous stress and we see still a shortage of quality mental health care that permeates our entire society, but is especially acute with an angry male population that has access to guns. Right?
Paul, so it's interesting that and you talk to suicide prevention advocates, any hurdle you can put in between somebody thinking about suicide and the ability to take their life and ends up being incredibly effective. There's a three or four bridges. There's a infamous bridge in Rock Creek Park in Washington, D.C. that was sadly a favorite spot for people to jump and take their life. For years, suicide prevention advocates were trying to put in the, and there are these new things that just make it harder to climb on a bridge, right? To climb up and all this stuff. And lo and behold, they finally put that in there. And instead of 12 suicides a year, I think they had none the following year. And it wasn't because there are fewer mentally, you know, challenged people who are thinking about it. It's just that you took away easy access.
Yeah.
And, you know, I lost my friend growing up in high school, mother died in a murder suicide. If the gun wasn't in the house, maybe that bad night is just a bad night. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
And it's so I don't know how we, it's interesting on the suicide front. Is this a way to finally have a conversation about guns differently?
Because yes.
Veteran suicide, you know, maybe we can take out some of the partisanship there, right?
Look, I think that veterans are always a very powerful political entity. Right. You and I have talked about so many issues over the last 20 years and they can be manipulated like I think President Trump often did for political advantage, or they can be a lead element in understanding things like cannabis or canine therapy or access to guns or mental health. So we can be kind of a Trojan horse for some of the more difficult conversations in this country. And I know I'm working in this space and frankly, having vets call me in the middle of the night for decades. Hope and connection are the two things that stop suicides. Now, how do we expand that aperture? But I think there's a bigger issue that's rumbling across the country that veterans have always been kind of a canary in the coal mine for. And I think what I see in the veterans community and in the independent community all across the country is pain, grievance, anger, division, a disconnection from community. And I think that is happening all across America. I think it's especially acute among white middle class and lower class men that we've talked about around January 6th and the rise of extremism and our politics. But I think you're seeing that among the veteran population in particular, which is pre-screened for mental health issues. Right. They're less likely to be on drugs. There's a lot of reason why their suicide numbers should be lower than the general population. But it's no time for celebration, but it is a time to try to explore what's really happening in America. And if veterans can't get good health care and can't get mental health care, what does that say about the rest of America? We are often a mirror on America at a time when America needs it the most. Because there's a side of like a decimation that happened in the veterans community that nobody talked about, which was COVID. COVID killed old people.
Right.
World War II veterans made up a huge percentage of our old people. So we lost maybe hundreds of thousands of World War II veterans, all those
nursing homes. And a lot of Korean War.
Nursing home death, and it was a man, it was probably a World War II veteran. So there's been a huge decimation of our community, also at a time when the Vietnam veterans are dying in very high numbers due to Agent Orange exposure. So I think I've said this to you in the past, the demographics of veterans are like the opposite of the Hispanic population in America. Like we are
very old.
We're going to go from like, you know, double digits percentage of the populations to a very small single digit. And that's going to create a lot of political confusion and even manipulation. If you look at what I think is coming, where you're going to have a generation from both political parties that are going to run veterans.
I want to pause there, but before we go to break, I want to make you aware of some available resources. If you or someone you know is in crisis, call 988. It's to reach the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline. You can also call the network, previously known as the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. They're available at 800-273-8255. You can also text HOME to 741741 or visit speakingofsuicide.com/resources for additional places to seek some help. We're going to be right back. You're listening to the Chuck Todcast from Meet the Press.
Boy, that's a fascinating, because we've already seen a shrinking veterans population. And it's a, you know, I talked with Chuck Hagel recently, and he talked about when he first got in the Senate, Bob Dole and Dan Inouye were the World War II veterans that were in the Senate that sort of were a part of the captains of that club. And then you had Hagel and the two Kerrys, and you had a Vietnam McCain, you had a Vietnam crew. I don't sense any of that right now with the younger set, Tom Cotton, say a Jason Crow. I don't sense that. There isn't a connectivity there. Maybe there will be in 10 years, but I do think they're such partisan warriors that partisanship trumps military service.
Yeah, I mean, veterans are not a monolith, and they are outliers in some areas, but they're also a reflection of our society, and our society is polarized around politics. So what veterans often become are proxies in the culture war, right, for both sides. But I do think there is an opportunity for bipartisanship. We saw that around the PACT Act for burn pits. You'll see it sometimes around national security issues. But I also think what we're looking at is in the next 20 years, the great veterans proxy war, and it'll be for the White House. Because what you're seeing now is Ron DeSantis running. He's going to run in large part on his Navy service as a JAG when he served overseas. And then there are other people that are rising up pretty quickly, like Westmore.
Westmore would be one.
And for many years, we used to say it was going to be Eric Greitens versus Westmore for president. Well, Greitens is off the table, at least for now. But it looks like it could be DeSantis versus Moore. And that will be a really interesting wave of veteran candidates, because the Vietnam veterans, Chuck Hagel, as an example, used to often talk about how they got close, but they never got the White House.
They never got a president.
There was a time when they had three cabinet secretaries. They had Hagel, they had Shinseki, and they had Kerry. But McCain and Kerry never got the White House. And how different would our society be? How different would Iraq and Afghanistan have been? Would our entire post-9/11 reaction have been if our country had been shaped by at least one Vietnam veteran in the White House?
More importantly, what does it say that we did elect three baby boomers president? I don't count Obama as a pure baby boomer. He wasn't 18 during the Vietnam War. So I don't right in the tweener.
Yeah.
But W, Clinton, and Trump, not only were they not veterans, all three finagled their way out, right? Look, and by the way, so did my dad. He did it on the up, like a lot of people did.
Yeah.
I will tell you this. My dad knew he kept a folder. I will never believe people like Richard Blumenthal who say they forget. You don't forget. My dad knew his number. He knew every deferral he got because it was everybody of fighting age knew. Yeah. You knew. Yeah. So the idea, I'm not sure which foot, BS. You know the foot because you were trying to prevent
it's
from
true.
Going. But what does it say that not only did we not have a Vietnam veteran, we ended up with three Dodgers?
Again, I think it's a reflection of our society. I think that what's really happened post-Vietnam is we've developed an all-volunteer military that we love to praise and love. I'm in New York City. Fleet Week is happening this week. Everyone loves to stand up there and wave, but their kids aren't going. And the professional military has been great for our military, but I will argue has been terrible for our democracy. When it's a small group of people that go over and over again, and it's largely the same families in the same areas that go over and over again, it creates a very dangerous division when it comes to the cost of war. And I think that extends to Iraq and Afghanistan, but it also extends to things like January 6th and the fighting of domestic terrorism and the understanding of how the Oath Keepers are operating. There's a deep misunderstanding of national security. And I think that extends to our conversation now around Ukraine as well. There's a reason why veterans, so many of my friends, are there now. They want to continue to serve. They feel a connection to this fight like the World War II generation did. So it feels like we're almost a different kind of society within the society that's been compounded over the last 20 years. But there's also another wave that I will flag for you and your listeners that I hope I come back to talk to you about a lot more. 50% of my generation of veterans are politically independent. They are unaffiliated. Many of them are not in the political game because they don't feel like they have a home. They're not Republicans. They're not Democrats. And they're not necessarily middle either or forward party or some other.
No, they have their own issues, but they don't feel like either party
is. What they are is they're none of the above.
Right.
They're none of the above, but they consider themselves independents. They consider themselves country first. And we see 60% of young people are also unaffiliated and independent. 49% of this country now considers themselves unaffiliated and independent. And
I think but it doesn't mean they're centrist. And I do think that's the mistake people make.
Correct.
And that's the I was with a group that's trying so hard to figure out, like, how do we – the primary – you know, this group, it's called Unite America, and they're trying to reform the primary process. They think the primary system
is free. I know them
well.
Yep.
And I'm like, I love what they're trying to do.
I think they're onto something important because when we talk
about – So do I.
In my view, our democracy is under attack, and it has to be defended, and it has to be improved. And I think two – important ways to do it are the structural reform that's necessary, particularly around open primaries, because those 49% of
whether it's top two, ranked two, whatever it takes to get
open primaries,
more independence to be able to
open primaries is maybe key, because tens of millions of Americans are basically disenfranchised from elections that matter, and 50% of them are veterans. So 50% of my generation of veterans can't vote in the primaries that matter. I think that's one, but I also think there's a lack of leadership that transcends party. And if you talk about a Chuck Hagel or a Bob Kerry, they wouldn't be in a political party right now. They would probably, a Colin Powell, or we could use an example like The Rock or someone else that transcends party and brings people together. I think there is an opportunity for that. And it may not be at the presidential level, but it is happening at the state and city level. Like we saw, for example, in Colorado Springs with the new mayor, right? There is a thirst for someone who says, F you.
And he was an independent. And he was an independent, non-affiliated with the party.
Right.
Let me ask you about the uniform leadership. General Milley, here's a guy who I think has correctly identified the problem, but I think has incorrectly gone about trying to deal with it. I think he's sometimes too online. He too sees what's happening too well.
Yeah.
And at the same time is very aware they've got a recruitment issue. They've got a polarization within the ranks issue. I feel like the uniformed leaders feel constrained and they don't know. They know there's a problem and they're afraid to speak out. Maybe that's what it is. But what's your sense?
I think that they are constrained by the job. Okay. Whether it's General Milley, it was Admiral Mullen in the past. Like the chairman of the Joint Chiefs has a unique opportunity to shape the national understanding of military affairs, a conflict of service. Some of them are better at it than others. I thought that Mullen and Gates were an amazing duo that took on some of the hardest issues of our time during some of the most dicey times, right? Like it was an incredibly tough time. And I think they were a really important duo. I don't think you've seen that kind of a duo working in concert with a president who also understands the media and political environment. So they kind of get gobbled up by the politics, but they're not the only ones. So does Biden, right? Biden's having a hard time communicating too. So some of it is a generational issue, but I also think it cuts back to the core of what we were talking about. There aren't a lot of really powerful, trusted, elected leaders that are talking to America, right? You've got Tammy Duckworth, you've got Tom Cotton, but they're not really transcending like a presidential candidate could to help shape some of these issues.
Well, Wes more intrigues me on that.
Oh, stuff. I think Wes is coming. I mean, I said this long ago. Yeah. I think Wes, will very quickly be a presidential candidate. I think he could be a presidential candidate in 4 years. I think if something happens to Biden's health, he immediately jumps to the front. I think people are sleeping on how fast Wes is coming. He's a friend. I wish he was an independent, but he's a Democrat and I love him. But I think he's a very special leader that's coming on fast. But I think the bigger issue is that the country is starved for leadership, leadership with integrity, leadership that they trust. And the military is kind of a go-to. Right.
And it doesn't feel like it's there. You're right. And it's like, when I think about, boy, we could really use an alternative to Trump and Biden. And I say this, it's clear the country wants an alternative.
They do.
But there isn't a business leader that you sit there and you go, you know, in the 80s when you and I were kids, maybe I'm aging you too quickly. But in the 80s, it was Lee Iacocca.
Sure.
He was considered, and people loved him left and right. Oh, yeah, I like that guy. And he had a personality. He was also out there and all this stuff. In the 90s, it was Colin Powell, even Norman Schwarzkopf, right? We looked at our military leaders as the answer. I don't know if Dwight Eisenhower exists, we haven't met him.
I think this is, again, like a reflection of our culture. I mean, I keep using this as an example because when you text the polling, you see it's The Rock. It's like this is a celebrity time.
The two. Well, it's funny. Or I would give you another one. I actually think
Donald Trump got elected, right? Everybody dismissed him. But if The Rock jumps in right now as a third party candidate, and obviously ballot access is an issue. But I use that not as a conversation to talk about.
I totally agree with you, Paul. Right? I know that. Not only that, I think right now the one politician in America who might be able to sort of bridge the divide is Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Yeah.
And he's ineligible.
Yeah.
But here's a guy that like
– I think you're touching on something I talk about a lot. I mean, it's been Ross Perot and then it's been, you know, folks like Steve Forbes and many others that have tried, but they haven't really had that authenticity and that trust and that charisma that really transcends all of it and can pull it all together. I think there remains a very serious opportunity for a third party candidate, but not like No Labels is saying, where they say, hey, we're going to draft a quarterback and a running back, but we're not going to tell you who we're going to draft.
Yeah. Right? I think the problem with it this year, though, Paul, is that Trump, I think too many people are aware that I'm either voting for.
Oh, I don't think it's this year, Chuck. I'm not talking about this year.
Right.
I think people really think about this independent movement, which is what I call it. And now I've dedicated a lot of my life to. I mean, we view it as a movement that is generational. I think you're starting to see the change happen where the environment is right, where you've got open primaries, you've got ranked choice voting, you've got charismatic leaders, you've got more independent thinking voters like Alaska or Maine, right? Where the conditions are right. Can be the future of what American politics looks like. My view is that we need to make more of the country look like that to repair our politics and cultivate better leaders. There's one other thing I got to talk about on this issue, Chuck.
Okay.
Because of this dynamic within the Pentagon, and I think some of the weakness of the Democrats to communicate, the culture war is now fully engulfed the Pentagon and Department of Veterans.
That's the sense I've gotten,
and
that rank and file, it's very ugly.
Tommy Tuberville is a radical, you know, extreme, in my view, leader of the, you know, not even a leader, but a figure in the Republican Party that is single-handedly stopping hundreds of nominations to admiral and general and flag grade at the Pentagon over his personal crusade against abortion. This is against the norm. Senators don't hold up promotion, you know, to admirals and generals. Right. But he's done this because Fox News and he and other, I think, extreme right-wing folks have decided that the Pentagon is going to be their pinata to bang on.
Right.
And similarly, the VA has become a battleground on abortion where there's actually been an expansion of care. And if you're a civilian woman and you need emergency abortion care, you can go to the VA to get services.
Right.
So the VA is actually the battleground for abortion, in my view, where the line is actually moving, right. And the Pentagon is not moving. It's kind of at a stalemate, but they're both battlegrounds now. The VA and DOD are not off limits, and guys like Tuberville are going to be kind of like a forward right. edge of attacking the Pentagon. Can you imagine, Chuck, 20 years ago, a senator attacking the Pentagon?
I know. And not getting pummeled for it, right? And a Republican senator. We're dancing around something else here, right? The thing that I think we've just been used to it. The military has been the thing that has kept us together. It has bridged the divides between rural and urban when nothing else would. It bridges the divide between class sometimes, because there's nothing like boot camp to be an equalizer, right?
Yep.
But obviously we have a recruitment issue. When you see what, I mean, you know, it's interesting that the massive leak with the National Guardsmen mm-hmm. up in Massachusetts, the fact that the military has to use a National Guardsman for this tells you what's wrong, right?
Well, I'll take it a step further.
Their inability to find quality people, they end up having to take anybody that comes in.
I wouldn't be so quick to bang on the National Guardsman. I'll tell you, usually it's a civilian contractor.
Yeah,
because what we've actually done is outsourced huge percentages of our military post 9/11 to contractors. We're lucky he wasn't a Raytheon employee, right? Mm-hmm.
Edward Snowden was a contractor, right? I mean,
while America wasn't looking, and while someone else's sons and daughters have been off to war for 20 years, it's been a feeding frenzy for contractors at the Pentagon, where mm-hmm. a lot of basic functions like logistics. And data collecting that used to be done by an enlistee or even by a draftee is now being outsourced. So I am a big fan of national service and finding ways to get young
people. I think we have to make it mandatory.
No politician is willing to take that, except it feels like, and I got to give him credit here, Wes has started that conversation in Maryland. He's funding a year of service. Yeah, and I think he's the right kind of leader who can make that argument to the country.
I'm convinced. Look, our biggest problem in our politics is the fact that the rural America is so far away from everybody else, culturally, intellectually, resource wise. We have, and that now that it's a homogenous one party, when rural America was 60-40 between the two parties, you know, it kept both parties. I think it grounded them a little bit, but the it's obvious the Republican Party doesn't live in the suburbs anymore, based on what they're advocating. And it's pretty obvious Democrats don't ever step foot in rural America anymore. And I'm worried about this. And I think national service, to be frank, is the only way out of this. It's going to take us a generation to recover from this segregation, from this
I think you're
geographic
right about
segregation. And that national service is one of the – if we're not – because it used to be that urban guy and that suburban, you know, rural guy might be in boot camp together. Well, now they're not, but maybe they'll, you know, if you create a national service program that allows, you know, people that want to work on environmental issues, they can do that. You want to work on national cybersecurity issues, you can mm-hmm. do that. And, you know, all the things that the Army of all the, I think the Army does this the best in their recruitment videos. You know, this whole, we know Gen Z is a service oriented generation. I just think that that's the way to tap into that.
I think you're right about your prescription. I think the diagnosis is pretty complex. I think national service is one of the few things that could bind us together, but you have to get to the root cause. And I think the rural divide is important. The two-party duopoly is important. The media environment's important. The class division is important. But there's a deeper thing here. People don't feel connected to America. They don't want to sign up to serve something, because the hard truth is that a new generation doesn't give a shit about America like the older generations did. Now, some do, right? And but the broader population, it is much more complicated. They have a much different relationship with the country and the flag and the leaders. And that's not just, you know, radical lefties. It's also righties and veterans, and everybody is having kind of a really difficult time with America. And that gets us to a point where they're reluctant to raise their right hand, and they're reluctant to send their kids. You know, Tommy Tuberville is banging away at the Pentagon saying it's too woke. Here's what I see as someone in the veterans community. You have to recruit women. Women from New York and California do not want to join the military and lose their access to abortion care if they get stationed in Alabama. New York and California are something like 17% of the entire population. And if you look at women from New York and California, the military's in trouble. And that is a bigger issue that I think gets lost in the sauce, but also just the connection with this country. Reimagining what patriotism looks like, where it doesn't feel like a jingoistic fascist thing. And it's going to take leaders like Wes, I hope DeSantis, I'm not holding my breath on that, to reshape what patriotism means. And it might take a crisis. COVID didn't do it. 9/11 did it for a couple weeks. But in the absence of really incredible leadership, I don't know what's going to do it, Chuck. I really do. So I have hope and faith in my veteran brothers and sisters that, you know, once one more time we can answer the country's call and one more time we can bail us out or hold the line or take the bullet, whatever we want to use. But I think this is really the fight of our time, especially for veterans. We have to find out how to protect, defend, and improve our democracy, which is right now under attack and flailing, in my opinion.
Well, it goes back, you and I've talked about this before, you know, not many people in America have credibility. A veteran gets to start with a little more credibility than most.
Yeah. Well, we don't have a Zelensky, but we do have a model to look for. And it's interesting at a time where Ukraine feels more American than America does. And I think it's a good time on Memorial Day to reflect on, you know, why are veterans joining the fight in Ukraine?
I'm curious. Is there a pattern here? Is it more veterans of Afghanistan joining than veterans of Iraq?
No.
Okay.
It's veterans because people who raised their, and I've had a number of them on my podcast to talk deeply about this, veterans who were there, veterans who were reporting from there. Like I said this to Adrian Bronnenberger, who was on my show. He's a Ranger who went over there for the spring offensive. I asked him, I said, does this feel more pure than anything you fought in? He said, yes. Afghanistan didn't feel this right. Iraq didn't feel this right. He's in Ukraine.
Well, because what's the big difference? The people really want him there, right? Like, I hate to say, in Afghanistan, it was never clear. We were trying to liberate people. Did they want to be liberated?
Bad guy. There's a clear goal. And I think that this, I've said this before, I think it's the fight of our time. I think it's nothing like we've seen since World War II. We're going to see a spring offensive or a summer offensive that will be like what we haven't seen since World War II in terms of intensity and scope of combat. And I think this is a defining point for America, too, to decide how are we going to be involved? Are we going to continue to make them play Mother May I? Or are we going to really go all in here on this important fight?
Look, as a national security policy, it is remarkable. I'm going to quote Newt Gingrich. Who before the midterms made the point, he goes, you know, whatever anybody wants to say about Biden, the guy's figured out how to defeat the Russian army without a single U.S. boot on the ground.
I think that's right. This is the underreported.
We're not done yet.
5% of our defense.
This is something else.
5% of our defense budget to annihilate half of the Russian military. That's a pretty good return. Not a single American.
Can you imagine that deal in the Cold War?
That is an incredible return on investment. I think the national security, everything.
History's going to treat this pretty well.
Everything is national security, Chuck. And I think we're suffering from a time in America where there's a real lack of leadership to frame all national security issues, whether it's Ukraine or the threat of domestic extremism. And I think that this is Memorial Day is a great time to reflect on it, right?
Like absolutely.
Rather than just, you know, going to the beach, take a minute to reflect and think about the generations that have come before us. And I do have some hope that veterans in particular can rise to this moment and lead, but they don't want to get involved in politics. So we've got to frame.
I get that too.
Right.
That's,
I think, key.
Paul Rykoff, you always make me think, and I hope the listeners feel the same way. You bring so much energy and passion to this. I'll tell you this. I'll sign up for whatever you're leading, my friend.
Well, thank you, my friend. I appreciate you always keeping a focus on it, Chuck. Every year you do, and we know it, and we appreciate it, and it's a conscious moment for America, and I appreciate it.
All right, brother.
Thanks, Chuck.
You've been listening to the Chuck Toddcast from Meet the Press. A quick programming note. The Toddcast will be off this Sunday, but please keep your eye out for our special edition on the crisis in the court. It'll be available on the Meet the Press podcast feed and, of course, on your local NBC News station Sunday morning. Today's episode was produced by Justice Gilpin Green and Elias Miller. Theme music composed by Spoke Media. Meet the Press now live every day at 4 p.m. Eastern on NBC News Now. And Meet the Press Reports is available to watch anytime, wherever you find NBC News programming. Until we upload again.